Good day, everybody. This is Kanaz File, and I'm here with my friend Anaf Ibekanis. Say hello, Anaf.
Good day, Sir Kinaz. Afternoon where I'm at, morning when you're at. I believe this is part four, so we're
This
on a
is
roll
part
here.
four. We are on a roll.
Fantastic. All right, good sir. What would you like to discuss today?
Well, I was thinking we'd started talking last week about one of the big problems is how so few people in our movement are actually serious. You get a lot of posturing, you get a lot of very performative chest thumping. You don't get a lot of sitting down and, okay, doom is coming, or at the very least, we're looking at, a hard economic downturn and a deteriorating standard of living, as well as increasing political oppression. How do we deal with this as adults? And I'm going to gas the X and kill the Y and send the Z back to Africa is not a serious logical response to that. That's a child throwing a tantrum. And I think
Yeah,
we need to, how do we get to people thinking seriously? And I had, some ideas on that. I think, one of the things we need to do is start asking ourselves, our solutions, the solutions we're coming up with, and we should be coming up with prospective solutions to help in these situations. Are they practical? And prove they're practical by thinking out what's involved in them. It seems like that would be common sense, but I don't really see people doing that. A lot of what passes for strategizing, particularly on the right, will be either the, ooga booga, my ethnicity good, your ethnicity bad, or, here's 101 ways exposing how this whole gang of conspirators really control things. And, if exposing these conspirators was going to stop them, well, wouldn't they have been stopped by now? I mean, it's not hard for me to find out the Rothschilds rule the world.
No, definitely there's a lot going on here. Now that you mention it, good sir, I was watching Az al-Din yesterday. Are you familiar with him?
Az al-Din?
Yeah, Az al-Din.
Az al-Din
is... So Az al-Din is the gentleman, along with Jackson Hinkle, they coined the term MAGA communism, right? And I was like, okay, this is probably one of those like LARP type things. It's probably non-serious. I mean, they're probably, because in my head, it's like, okay, well, communism and MAGA, they're completely separate things, right? But no, I was watching an interview he did with DD Geopolitics, which is like one of those middle-sized geopolitics channels, right? But he said something very interesting. He's like, the reason why the Europeans, right, and the right wing in general, they always blame the Jews, right? They always blame the Jews, all these like Jewish families and everything, has to do with their temperament, right? And I didn't understand what he was getting at, but I watched the whole thing. Like, maybe I'll link it to at the end of this interview we're doing. But no, he was basically saying that, look, when Hitler was doing his thing, right, in World War II, right, he always blamed the Jews, always blamed the Jews. Why? Because if you read Mein Kampf, it was like, well, look, if the Jews win against the Aryan super race, what's going to happen? Well, all the other races of the world, the blacks, the Eurasians, the Mongoloids, and so on and so forth, right? They're going to rise up, right? So the Jew is the enemy of the white because they are going to rise up and our hegemony is going to end, right? So it's very funny, right? So what he was trying to get at was that, okay, it's not just that the Jews are being blamed because, Europe has this big history of like pogroms and all this other stuff. Rather, they're being blamed because they are just similar enough, right? Obviously, there's big differences between them and white people, right? But they're just similar enough to the point where white people can blame them. And in doing so, they take away agency from all the other people of the world, right? So they're like, okay, well, the only reason they're rising up is because, us white people are being lazy. And, they're getting lucky. And oh, by the way, the Jews are helping us. Jews are helping them, rather. Right.
Yeah.
So again, and so I was watching it and I remembered what you were telling me about a week ago about everyone being non-serious. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is literally what's happening right now. It's like you're denying people agency and you're like blaming the Jewish people and so on and so forth. Right. Now, Hitler, right, was, I think, at the very end, right before he committed suicide, he did say that, oh, the Eurasian Mongoloid, you know, the who invaded Europe, they're about to win, right? And so at the very end, right before he died, right, he did admit that, okay, they actually have agency and they're the ones who are winning the war, not the freaking Jews, right? So, no, it's funny stuff. I mean, honestly, I think that most of the chest thumping that you were talking about, good sir, comes from this ideal that, okay, well, even though we're 10% of the world population, somehow the reason we're losing is because of this tiny minority of people who've got extensive influence and lobbying power and whatnot. And the thing is, right, even if you do have families like that, whether it's the Rothschilds or all these other guys, there's just not enough of them, right? This is what I try to, and Hazaldin also mentioned this as well. It's like, okay, well, yeah, they have influence and power, and okay, so they're, you know, pursuing their interests, whether it's Zionism, all this other stuff. But like, whenever people talk about them, it's like, oh, they have galactic super brain and superpowers, which you can never overcome, which is complete bullshit.
I know. Absolute nobody bullshit. Ever makes conspiracies about the Emirate princes or the Sultan of Brunei, yeah, or people who have access to levels of like Rothschild levels of money.
Yeah, yeah. The Sultan of Brunei, yeah, the Sultan of Brunei has like $200 billion. And I think like the UAE family, the Emirati family has like $400 billion in accumulative wealth, right? But nobody's talking about them, right? They always focus on the Jews all the time, right? So, no, this is, I found that fascinating. I found yesterday's Hazaldin interview fascinating. I'll definitely send it over to you.
I definitely want to say, I mean, I think one of the things that I found is helpful when I try to steer conversations on Telegram or other places is, okay, AIPAC, the ADL, there are definitely large Jewish organizations that protect Jewish interests and that you could argue, I mean, I would argue, have undue influence on American foreign and domestic policy.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
A group. You're pointing at them and saying, I don't like these people because they do this. You know, the Jews is kind of like, you know, it's smaller than the Muslims, but you're still talking 15 million people. You know, I mean, it's not the Jews that are doing this. It's these two groups that are doing it. They're open for criticism. That's fair game. You know, you're not an anti-Semite for saying you don't like George Soros funding, you know, radical DAs. You know, you're not an anti-Semite for saying Harvey Weinstein was a pervert. You know, that's like, you know, you are an anti-Semite if you think, you know, Jews are basically beaming like thoughts into the back of, into your dental fillings. You know, that's, you know, that's just, I mean, I think the word anti-Semite at this point has been beaten to death. You know, it doesn't really mean anything anymore other than like somebody who says something that that angers Zionists. I mean, I kind of like the old word Jew hater, let's call it, which is what anti-Semite was originally intended to be a substitute for. Do you hate Jews? I mean, if you're saying that you believe Jews are sacrificing Christian children in rituals, then, I mean, you either hate Jews or there's something wrong with you, because, like, you should hate people who sacrifice children. I mean, maybe you're just doing this to get a rise out of people, but, I mean, you know, that's hatred. Criticism is criticism. Anybody is open. Any religion, any race, any group should be open for fair criticism.
Precisely, precisely. And the thing is, fair criticism is when you are rational with regard to what it is your projections are, right? You can project, you can be like, okay, well, based on X, Y, Z, we can say A, B, C, right? But like, for example, right, and I'll bring up Hazaldin again. He was like, okay, look, there's actually like right-wing people out there who basically say that, look, the Chinese Communist Party and its founding and all these other things, right, it's all related to the Jews. Why? It's because there's like two free Jewish doctors who went over there to volunteer, right? And these are like third tier, fourth tier people, like actually like salt of the earth people, just like volunteering at the ground level. And like, apparently these are the guys who like influence the leadership. And he just laughed, like Hazaldin laughed. He basically said that, look, it's so hilarious. It's like, oh, if you ever had one or two Jewish people help you out at the supermarket, now you're involved with the Jews. That's basically what it is, right?
It also assumes that the Chinese are such, you know, poor, backward, primitive people that there's absolutely no way they could have come up with something like the Long March without Jews helping them.
Precisely.
It's like, you know, know Chinese history, sir?
This is exactly. And see, this is the point I'm trying to get at with all these like tangents. It's like, the reason why people are not serious in the West. I think Colonel Douglas McGregor, he had this quote. Somebody else said it, but he basically said one of his friends told him that America is not just on a different continent. It is on a different planet, right? And the reason it's on a different planet is because agency is not given to the rest of the world, right? It's like, okay, well, there's 800 million or so white people, give or take maybe a few million here and there, right? And then these are the people who are the real decision makers, right? And inside that decision-making group, there's like the so-called Jews who have all this like undue influence and power. And they're the ones who are kind of like maneuvering all these other races and ethnicities and whatnot to do their bidding, which I've always found like a fascinating cope. Like I just view it as a big fat cope, viewing the world in that lens, right? But no, that's the thing. And I think the reason, like, this is my pet theory, right? But I think the reason there's so much cope and unseriousness and all this other like stuff going on is because a lot of people never graduated from that mindset. Right. A lot of people never graduate from the mindset of, okay, well, other people actually have agency. Other people actually have genuine interests, whether I disagree with them or not. Right. And they're going to make themselves heard. Right. Like, whether you like Russia or not, whether you like Vladimir Putin or not, he actually has genuine interests with regard to, okay, Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. We cannot allow Crimea to fall into your hands and so on and so forth. Similarly, Muslims have very, very strong theological interests with regard to Masjid al-Aqsa. I'm trying to finish up my essay for Arctos, the next one, part two, where I basically emphasize that, okay, look, if you guys touch this place, world wars are going to break up, basically, right? So that's how inviolable Masjid al-Aqsa is, right? But for these people, right, this subset of people on the other side of the pond, as they like to say, they are so unserious. They're like, okay, well, this is still all the actions of the Jews or some other group or so on and so forth, right? So they've never graduated from that. And honestly, good sir, I think we have to be selective with regard to who we talk to, right? Because there are some people who are like so unserious that no matter what evidence you give them or no matter what you tell them, they're always going to try and pin it on their ethnic group of choice. I mean, 9 times out of 10, it happens to be Jews. But like, you could even like find people who are like, okay, lizard men or some other stuff or what have you, right? So it's overall, it's an unserious thing, right? So it's just quality control at this point. It's like, okay, well, do we want to talk to these people or do we not, right? So that's the thing.
I mean, another one I've seen with like people who are talking about holding military tribunals, talking about politicians and doctors who should be executed for COVID or stuff. And it's like, okay, you're pushing the boundary of threatening violence. No, it probably is not a credible threat to violence under like the original American standard, but you're trying to get rises out of people, and then they're shocked, just shocked, when like Stripe demonetizes them or starts asking questions. It's like, you have to understand, you're talking about tyranny. One of the first things you learn in tyranny is what you can get away with and what will get you, you know, sent to prison, cost you your account or things. You know, if you want to get things done, this doesn't really help people. I mean, do you think that you're going to get, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez shot by a firing squad because you posted this on your Substack? No, but you might torpedo your Substack.
Yeah, precisely.
I mean,
precisely.
It's stupid and meaningless. You're not doing this for a good cause. You're doing this to get the rise out of I'm pushing the envelope. And I don't think we've really got time for that anymore, especially because the higher your profile gets, the more sensitive you have to be about what you say, you know. And I mean, that doesn't mean cucking to get it, to win a message, to get events. That means if I want to get my message out, I can't be seen as threatening violence. I can't be seen as hating minorities. Those are just things you will not be taken seriously if you do these things, and it could get you losing your social media account, which, you know, may have been a badge of honor once. At this point, it's a kind of a badge of stupidity because we know what we can get away with.
Yeah. No, people have this idea that, okay, I can just go out there and talk about this stuff and there's going to be no consequences for me, right? Whereas, you know, the reality of the situation is that if you're on the dissident side of things, right, you're not in power, you don't have influence and what have you, this is the most important thing, right? You have to be very careful on what you say, right? Now, if you want to say stuff and you just want to let loose, that's something different, right? But don't put it out there in public. I mean, this should be obvious.
I mean, I've said stuff on Telegram channels that was, I was joking, I wasn't serious, but, you know, I would not have made those posts in public.
Precisely, precisely. Yeah, no, it's, I don't know, like, obviously, I've not been in the West for a long time. I used to be, right, where back when I was at the nice list, but I've not been there in a while, so you could sort of probably know it better than I do, and you've been there far longer than me. But the limited time that I was there, right, one of the things I noticed was people always were very, very, and there's nothing wrong with this. I'm not trying to criticize this, right? But they were always very focused on their local and domestic stuff, right? And that's fine, right? That's totally fine. But you need to have some idea of what the rest of the world is doing, right? Because if you don't, right, you're going to get yourself into these situations which you can't really, like, salvage, right? Like, for example, with regard to saying stupid stuff on the internet, right? I mean, there's been decades in which, like, actual U.S. senators and congressmen, right? And it's not just Lindsey Graham saying, bomb Iran, right? It's not just that guy, right? It's like there's actual congressmen and senators saying stuff like, okay, we need to, like, nuke Iran, do this, do that. I mean, do you really think that they don't have English language media there and they're not watching you, right? Like, this is the kind of stuff which really breeds nemesis and reprisal, right? Don't talk like this, right? And if you actually mean it, right, don't say it out loud. Like,
if you mean it, drop the goddamn bomb. If you don't mean it, then, like, quit sitting here swinging your genitals around like it's a, like, you know, you're a baboon trying to reach dominance. No, you know, it's like, if you really want to do any of these things, bombing people, doing whatever, don't talk about them on the internet. It should be that simple. And it's kind of sad that it's not.
Yeah, and like, if you're a government employee, right? Not just a government employee, you're an actual sitting senator and congressman. Like, what on earth are you doing, right? You know, people talk about, oh, America loves its troops and its veterans, and that's bullshit.
That's,
like, if you guys talk like that on, like, primetime TV, that's like the Iranians look at that, I don't know, maybe a few moments later on their English news chat, English news media, and they're like, okay, the Americans are crazy. We got to, like, take out more of their guys. That's basically what they think. Like, it's not rocket science, folks. Like, if you make threats like that and you're like, okay, we're going to sanction Syrian kids and we're going to starve them and we're going to sanction Iran and bomb them and so on and so forth, when people see that stuff, they are motivated to engage in more violence and reprisal and revenge against you, right? And the truth of the matter is, I think Malcolm Chiune, he did the interview a few days ago. But the truth of the matter is, America is basically in the advanced stages of collapse now. It cannot do any airlift or sea lift to the theater of battle, which is meaningful, right? So what that means is, if war broke out in the Pacific, the only thing America can do is, okay, well, we have some stuff pre-positioned in South Korea and Japan, Taiwan and Philippines. We have to use that stuff. That's the army we got. That's the navy we got. And we cannot move, like, fuel, munitions, and all these other goodies there. Right?
And if China concentrated on that, on our bases, they could be gone in hours.
Precisely, precisely. And you know, you have people.
You keep talking about nukes. The Chinese aren't going to swing things around about them. If they did that, your bases in the Pacific are gone, and we don't have the capacity to rebuild new ones and pull another World War II.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, the bridge that went down, it's not going to be repaired, right? It's not going to be repaired by American hands, right? It's going to be repaired by people from overseas, right? And with regard to all that other stuff, no, good sir, you're 100% correct, right? And people don't understand this, right? You've got, like, intelligent people like Mearsheimer, right? He's intelligent, but he gets so many things wrong, right? But he was basically saying that, oh, you know, we should just focus on the Chinese now. We should focus on war in the Pacific, right? And Malcolm Chiune, he said best. He's like, bro, you can't even fight. Right? You don't have the ability to fight. You're like, oh, I'm going to focus on China. That's like, you know, okay, you're a cancer patient, you're terminally ill, and you're focusing on, like, you know, watering the plants. It's too late. It's too late. You're in 1988, 1989, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years, a few months here and there. But you're not going to fight China, right? The reason you're not going to fight China is because America's on the verge of collapse. That's basically what it is, right?
We got now, an it's old very... saying in the South, like, yes. You know, this person has an alligator mouth and a parakeet ass. And this is a case of, like, your alligator mouth is going to get your parakeet ass in trouble. We talk a big game. We can't back our game up. And I don't, I don't think it's malice or conspiracy. I seriously think our leaders, we just have such a sclerotic, bureaucratic class. We're like the late stage Ottoman Empire, literally that bad.
That's very bad.
We're the final days of the Ottomans. That's pretty much where I think we're at. That's the best modern example I can get. I mean, our governing class is so sheltered, has never actually had to deal with the consequences of their action. They've been surrounded by people that tell them good things about what they're doing and give them all these plans for the future that they sign off on that they have no way of implementing. But they, it doesn't matter because they won't be held accountable for it. We are literally in that stage here. And we all know how that story ended.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Americans have this view that the two oceans are going to protect them. And that's, I think we already discussed a while back in maybe episode one or two, why that's no longer the case. And then they have this view that, okay, well, when the Boogaloo happens or when World War III happens, all the young white men who are like, whatchamacallit, who are away from the military or they've stopped serving, they're going to suddenly, go back and try and defend the land. Like, bro, listen, it's very true that, okay, there's this martial class from the American South who have opted out of the military for a whole list of reasons, right? I mean, their parents have told them to leave. Their uncles have told them, okay, don't serve. This place is bad news now, right? But the thing is, if you're not organized, doesn't matter how well-trained you are. You always need a team. You always need a group of people, right? And unfortunately, lightly armed militias can only do so much, right? This is the thing, right? Before, in my part of the world, before the Iranians did their thing, right? And Iran really deserves a lot of credit for doing what they did, which is that they simply sent their military personnel out there into West Asia, and they simply trained people. They simply told people, okay, look, all of you already know what the mission is. I don't need to tell you what the mission is. He doesn't need to tell you what the mission is. You already know what the mission is, right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to teach you stuff. Right. I'm going to repeat it and I'm going to transfer my knowledge to you. And that way, when I leave, doesn't matter if they kill me, doesn't matter if they kill you. By that time, you've already taught all your students. Right. And you've already done all the other stuff. And what's going to happen is you'll have indigenous capability. Right. And this is the key. Right. And this is why America is so doomed, whereas the rest of the world will do fine. Indigenous capability is not just about manufacturing sector and having people to work the factory or like having skilled military people to run the militias. Indigenous capability is also about education. Education, education, education. And it's also about what you can teach, what you can repeat, and what you can transfer, right? And the thing is, right, Yemen's Ansarallah, right? Why is it that they're having such an easy time beating up the Americans? It's because literally, like, it's not just that every 9-year-old has a Kalashnikov. Every 18-year-old knows how to make sea mines and all these other things. It's not just that. It's also because these guys have the training, the know-how and whatnot to build everything indigenously, right? And so even if you take out a few of them, right, their students know how to keep going, right? And so this is where like, oh, you need a high IQ force. Or you hear this amongst some right-wing circle. They're like, oh, you need a high IQ force to do warfare. You need this, you need that. Oh, whatever. Hypersonic missiles, that's why only the Asians have them. Like, bro, it's, come on.
America still has this technology thing, and the American military has it. We need super weapons. It's like, no, you need weapons that work on the battlefield. Super weapons that work on the battlefield are wonderful. Touchy super weapons that you could fire a couple of times and then have to have a complete crew there to program them, maybe not so much. And we have the best tech. We have to send $1 million missile to take out one of their $20,000 drones, and we have a limited capacity to make $1 million missiles.
Yeah, exactly, right?
And that's the thing of being serious, is knowing, okay, what can I do? Not what would I like to do?
Yeah. No, it's, It's one of those things where, unfortunately, there has to be a large catastrophe, and only then will I think it'll finally sear itself into the people's minds and imagination, right? But they kind of, Americans view warfare the same way that the Germans viewed warfare, like in terms of technology, in terms of like qualitative leaps, in terms of these, like you were saying, good sir, these expensive weapon systems, which is not the case, right? I mean, look. You know, if we believe in the race and IQ stuff, right? Iran has an IQ average of like 80, and Japan has an IQ average of 108, right? And Japan's got like 125 million people, Iran's got 90 million. So it's a 40% discrepancy, right? And so just based on that, like 28 points is like two standard deviations almost, right? So it shouldn't even be a contest, right? Like Japan should be on Mars by now with regard to like weaponry and all these other things, right? But we see the complete opposite, right? I mean, Japan's basically like an obedient vassal to the Americans. It's got
Yeah.
some nice ships and submarines, but overall, its rocketry is garbage. It really is. Like compared to North Korea and Iran and these other guys, its rocketry is garbage. Artillery-wise, it's got some okay artillery, but nothing special. And like tanks and all these other things, I'll forget about it. Like literally, just forget about it. And in
I
terms of like
think things
paramilitary and all these
might
other things.
change as Japan slowly begins to realize they can no longer rely on America to protect them against China. Because never mind questions of IQ. I don't believe the Japanese are stupid people, nor do I think that they're politically naive. And, they've been able to have this very peaceful, protected society because of American military might keeping China out.
Precisely,
And
precisely.
they know that.
Yeah. There's going to be two main divisions in Japanese society. There's going to be the one group which says that, okay, we got to prepare for war with China, and the Americans are clearly not going to help us because they are not willing, ready, or able. That's going to be the first group. And the second group is going to be like, okay, guys, we cannot afford to go to war with China. We're going to be destroyed. So let's just have a diplomatic settlement. Let's do an amicable settlement, right? At this point in time, I don't know too much about Japanese politics, unfortunately, to comment. But I would like the second group to win simply because I think it would be such a big waste of lives and what have you, right? So, no, that's the situation. I mean, Japan is it's a tragic society, right? Like, we talk a lot about like Japanese will to fight, will to resist, and all this other stuff, right? But it's just the fact that whatchamacallit, it no longer is a society which has that ethos anymore, right? It's kind of like being beaten out rather out of them by the Americans.
But beaten out, but can that ethos return once you've no longer got the Americans beating? I mean, I don't know if we're ever going to see like Japanese imperialists again, but I can certainly see a place where, okay, we don't want to do a land invasion in Japan for the same reasons we didn't want to do one in 1945, just because maybe we'd be able to take this country, but it would be such a bloodbath that it's not worth it.
Yeah, that's the thing though. Like, people don't realize that the reason why the atom bombs were used, right? The reason why they were used was because they did not want, right? Truman did not want a bloodbath, right? Now, some of his generals did. Some of them are like, you know what? We're gonna lose 2 million Marines and all these other guys. That's totally fine, right? We gotta subjugate Japan, right? But basically, it was a big fat bluff. It was like, okay, well, look, we've got these wonder weapons, and if you don't surrender to us, right? We've got 30 more or whatever, right? Now, that's one theory. There's another scholar, I believe his name is Ward Wilson. He wrote a book, Six Myths rather of nuclear weapons. And his thesis was that actually the Japanese did not surrender because of the nuclear bombs, but rather they surrendered because they saw the Manchurian invasion of the Soviet Union invasion of Manchuria rather. And they realized that, okay, within the next few weeks or months, the Soviets are basically going to invade us, right? From the north through Hokkaido and down the south, right? So at that point, it was a very simple calculation. It said, okay, well, do we surrender to the Soviets or do we surrender to the Americans? Because if we surrender to the Soviets, what's going to happen is our royal family is probably going to get executed because of their political philosophy and what have you. Whereas the Americans are probably going to. Are you okay, good sir?
Yeah, just coughing a bit.
Oh, no worries, no worries. No, but what I was saying that the Japanese look at it and they're like, okay, well, the Soviets are going to probably kill our royal family, whereas the Americans are probably going to be like, okay, guys, yeah, just sign a few documents, say that you're not divine, say that you're not literally God's son on earth or what have you, and we'll let you live, right? And that's basically what happened, right? So they chose that future for themselves. So, no, I mean, again, I wish Japan all the best, but Japan is one of those countries which, unfortunately, it's just gotten to the point where I'm not sure what's going to happen next, right? But like I said, I hope that the second group prevails. So,
I mean, I think Roman society was pretty rotten to the core by the time the West finally collapsed. I mean, that's an interesting story. That one is one that makes me wonder with American history is the crisis of the third century, like the 200s, Rome was four different Romes at one point. You know, the place was falling apart. You got Diocletian, who kind of sort of is an administrative genius, kind of sort of cobbles a Western Eastern thing together that they managed to keep running for like another 200, like another 150 years. So it's like, I wonder, is that what will happen? You know, we'll wind up spending some time where we've got four different disunited states or disunited regions. Cause I can definitely see that happening because what is happening is it's a matter of resources. The American government does it. You can print money so long as you can force people to take your money, and America is losing the capability to force people to take its money.
Yeah, that's basically what it is,
you're going to see a hard economic downturn here. I'm not sure. I think I had said this in my last blog entry. You know, people tend to view the opposition based on the novel 1984, which is on Stalinist Russia, or on, you know, dystopias like Mad Max or The Hunger Games, where, you know, it's this warfare with these huge, enormous armies. I mean, I would expect more like things start falling apart and you start seeing war gangs controlling territory within the United States. Unofficially, but everybody knows that, like, the real people running, say, let's say Texarkana, are this particular cartel. Everybody knows they do it. We got the government here. We pretend we're members of the United States, but they're the people we go to for protection. They're the people responsible for pretty much everything that's going on within our society. That was what happened in Rome. You know, the Visigoths came in and took over. They generally were not very good leaders, but in time they got a few that were better leaders, and then they got Charlemagne, who happened to be an excellent leader.
I mean, that's still a very optimistic way of looking at things. I mean, I think the only reason that would not happen in today's world has to do with the fact that everyone's eyes would be on America at all times, right? And so even if a Charlemagne figure was about to be born or was about to, I don't know, ascend, it would not be allowed, basically. I mean, you know, if you look at, just to give you an idea, good sir, like in West Asia, right, there's always been like, okay, this opportunity for like leaders and whatnot to take shape. But whenever they've kind of popped their head out of the mole hole, so to speak, like they've been basically whacked, right? So I think that similar thing's going to happen. Like, you know, China had the century of humiliation where the warlords were supported by all these different like interest groups and what have you. And you had like the foreigners who had like the control of these trading posts on the coastal city, right? And that was half the reason why they had the trading posts. The other half was, okay, we're going to dump drugs into China and we're going to make sure that no leader figure comes out of it, right? So, no, I mean, dark days are ahead, because what's going to happen is, let's say you get like a Diocletian type figure, and you get like, I don't know, he manages to like pacify some of the situation. Let's say the Diocletian figure is born in Texas, right? So Texas is now its own country. California is its own like country. And then there's like, I don't know, 11 or 12 more different countries, right? Well, the thing is, everyone in the world will have their eyes in America, and they're going to make sure that America never rises, right? So they'll send like all this other, I mean, obviously I don't want this to happen, but I'm simply telling you what I think will happen based on human nature, right? So they're going to look at America and they're going, all right, well, America's screwed. So we're going to make sure that America stays screwed. And we're going to send these people over and we're going to screw with America, basically, right? So whether it's the fentanyl epidemic, we'll just increase the drugs by times 10, times 100. We'll keep them like dumb, drug infested, and so on and so forth. We'll keep them divided. We'll keep on doing all this other stuff. But no, like, unless there's another geopolitical earthquake, right, that's basically going to be the fate of America for the next few decades or so, unfortunately, right? And people might say that's a very harsh thing for me to say, but I'm simply saying what I think is going to happen. you know, I'm from that part of the world where people are very, very cutthroat with regard to what it is they wish to do. So whether it's us Bengalis who get the short end of the stick, or you know, some other group or what have you, right? I mean, the British basically, like, I don't know, what was it? They probably like starved 3 to 4 million of us on purpose.
Millions, yeah, they
Yeah,
basically
millions.
millions, yeah. No, the British occupation of India wasn't all like tea, crumpets, and Rudyard Kipling, which a lot of, you know, people in America have this odd idea that it was. And you know, well, no, it, you know, it really was not. It's, you know, it was, you know, arguably, you know, was it less violent than the Mughals? I don't know. Did the Mughals ever starve millions of people to death because they were having a food shortage in their own home kingdom?
Not
No.
that we know of.
No, I mean, it's like definitely empires tend to be run. There's always going to be a certain amount of brutality involved, and sometimes it's public brutality and it's ugly, but it appears to be an inescapable part of empires. But Britain was exceptionally good at it. I mean,
Precisely,
they were,
precisely.
they basically, yeah, the Br people have no idea that the British Empire, how much bloodshed the British Empire was responsible for in the West. I mean, I'm sure in the Islamic world, they're very, very well aware of all of those incidents.
And people hold on to grudges. That's the thing, right? I try to explain to people, like, people hold on to grudges, and it depends on which part of the world you go to, right? But if you go to a place like Iran, right, you'll find like clerics there. Like, these are people in leadership class, right? They are either in the second tier or third tier. They may not be the top people, right? But they're like, I don't know, 40 years old or something. They're a cleric. They got like 5 or 6 kids, and you know, they'll talk emotionally about a massacre, right? And they'll explain to you, oh, here's how the children were being killed. Here's how the women were being oppressed. And then you pause, and then he pauses, and then you ask them, okay, so when did this happen again? And they'll be like, oh, it happened 1300 years ago, right? So
Yeah.
this is the kind of people you're dealing with, right? And so I try to explain this to Americans, but they never understand it, right? I try to explain to them that, look, when you killed General Qasem Soleimani in 2020, when Trump did that, right? Iranians have a very, very long memory. They're going to get their pound of flesh, right? It may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but they're going to, shall we say, get it, whether it's via the interest or whether it's via something else, right? And again, right, Americans have this view that, okay, well, look, if we just, whatchamacallit, if we threaten them or something, nothing's going to happen. And oh, look, hey, they didn't do anything to us, right? Oh, they shot a bunch of ballistic missiles, but nobody died. Wink, wink, nod, nod. That's the
Yeah.
official story. But oh, nothing happened after a week, nothing happened after a month. Okay, fantastic. They didn't do anything to us. Hooray, right? And I'm like, bro, this is completely ass backwards, right? You need to understand that they have their own time frame, right? They're an ancient civilization. They look at time differently than you do. They look at
They
time.
don't realize that the Persians have been a big deal since the Bronze Age. I mean, our
Exactly.
civilization can't understand that because we're only 200 years and change old.
That's basically it, right? And they're like, oh, we don't understand them, and we're not going to try to understand them. We're going to foist our standards onto them. So what that looks like is, oh, you've not done anything for a month. That means you're not going to do anything, period. Which, again, it's I don't know. I
Americans
try to
don't
explain it.
do foreign policy. We don't understand foreign policy. You know, the only foreign policy we knew was wielding an economic cudgel, and we don't have that. And we don't even have a Kissinger level diplomat here. You know, may the man rot in hell, but let's give credit where credit's
Exactly.
due. He was a smart, you know, if there were a crisis, I'd much rather have Henry Kissinger in charge of handling the crisis than some of the idiots we've got around here today. You know, it's like, not because I like the man, because I think he'd be more likely to come up with some kind of a solution.
No, I mean, Kissinger, I mean, obviously, may he rot in hell, but Kissinger actually was competent in his job, right? His job was, okay, well, America is the hegemon. How do you maintain hegemony, right? And Kissinger knew what to do, right? And one of the reasons why, even though Nixon dumped the gold standard and America still trundled along for about 50 plus years or so, that period is coming to an end, right? One of the reasons is because Kissinger was far-sighted enough to realize that, okay, well, if we informally, right, not formally, if we informally tie the American dollar to oil, right, we can still do stuff, right? Because again, it's the most important commodity with regard to, okay, well, everyone uses oil in some, you know, part of the value chain or what have you. So as long as we do that, we'll still be fine, right? So, but you don't have any visionaries like that with regard to like geopolitics, geoeconomics anymore. You've got people like Anthony Blinken, who's like, yeah, Ukraine's going to join NATO. What Ukraine, Mr. Blinken? Is it going to be the rump that's left over? Is it going to be the guy that, I don't know, has all these terrorists that you've armed who are going to be super pissed that you've not helped them out? And they're going to start like attacking Europe because you've given them all these weapons and promises and they were all for naught. Like, is that the Ukraine you're talking about? Because there's no way, right? Even your puppets in like Romania and all these other guys, right? Even they will be like, guys, maybe we should not like have a bunch of dudes with us in our European Union who have all these, like, I don't know, anti-tank systems, which can shoot down a leader's convoy from like 3 miles away or like can shoot down a plane that's about to come onto the runway and so on and so forth, right? So no, that's the situation, good sir. They're in for a world of hurt, basically.
Yeah, it's just our leadership class is so sclerotic, so, you know, like I said, it's just so crumbled. No living American diplomat has ever been in a situation where they had to negotiate from a position with a stronger party.
Yeah, exactly.
That's, you
this
know,
is why they don't understand. Yeah. Yep.
They think, well, we can tell you what to do and you will jump and do it. You know, what are you going to do when, as they're increasingly starting to do, they tell you to piss off?
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. No, it's unfortunate because America still thinks it's the 1950s, 1990s, I guess. Pick your year, I guess. So, no, they're trying to do this thing, which is going to fail. I mean, many Europeans still think it's 1950, right? And if you just call America, America will come and save the day, which is not the case, right? So, I mean, I actually feel bad for the people there. But honestly, like, if you elect leadership like this, you're going to reap the harvest. I mean, Finland, for example, for decades was neutral, right? But now that they've picked sides, right?
They picked Russia the worst possible time to pick a side.
Oh, yeah. No,
hey, I got a great deal on the price for this Titanic ticket.
Oh, man.
It's just like, what were you thinking, man?
And the thing is, right, they're like, oh, well, Russia is not going to do anything because America's not. Like, okay, look, listen. You have these Russian minorities living inside your borders. I mean, you've basically made your opinion clear with regard to what you want to do with them, whether it's kicking them out or whether it's like ethnically cleansing them outright. Like, do you really believe that the Russians are just going to sit there and inside your territory, you start doing that bullshit? Like, there's no way they're going to just sit there and let you do it. They're going to invade you. Right now, they may not
that's
want
an example
to
of unseriousness on like a state level, and that's what we're starting to see. You know, I mean, I'm asking people who read my Substack to be serious. My government isn't serious. You know, the diplomatic, you know, we're not ruled by serious people. You know, serious people don't act like Anthony Blinken. You know, I mean, it's okay. I don't care if you're a ranting fool on Substack. You know, there's lots of ranting fools on Substack. I'm sure you'll meet others that you'll have fun, you know, arguing with. But I would kind of like my Secretary of State not to be a complete drooling idiot. And it seems like I've been disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's these people, I honestly think, good sir, that at this point, it's too late. It's simply too late, right? This is like you were saying, it's the Ottoman Empire levels of like implosion and decline, right? No, like they're going to do their unserious stuff. Like, I mean, Finland elected Sanna Marin as prime minister. So that in and of itself should speak volumes on what kind of country that is. But no, they're going to do their thing. They're going to try and push their Russian minority out. And then there's going to be some other silly governments trying to do the same with their Muslim minority. And they're going to be super surprised when they notice that, oh, look, a suitcase nuke went off in XYZ locations, right? Oh, there's 100 of them that went off. Oh, and what happened? Oh, the Russian forces are entering our borders, and so on and so forth, right? People need to understand that nation states are one thing, right? But nation states are basically like a Westphalia, post-Westphalia invention after 1648. Prior to that, right, the idea of like very, very concrete borders between people, that was not a thing, right? You could go to the Holy Roman Empire. You could even go to like France and all these other places. It all came down to ownership of the nobles and the kingly classes and whatnot and what they owned. That was what the country was, right? But if you're going to be doing this stuff and you're picking fights with actual civilization states, you're going to lose. You're basically going to lose. And there's this like hopium. I don't want to call it copium. I'm going to just say hopium. But there's this hopium that, oh, look, the future is going to be more decentralized. No, it's not. It's very obvious. It's very obvious that even if technology becomes super, super decentralized and like individual bands of militiamen are running the show, they're still going to flock under common banners. So in the case of China, it would be Chinese civilization. In the case of Islam and the Islamic world, it would be under, you know, our faith and so on and so forth. So civilization states are here to stay. And you got to make peace with that. Now, if you want to pursue a nation state model as a European person and as a European state or society, that's totally fine, right? But you need to know what the rules of the game are. And rule number one is thou shalt not do stupid stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I might say rule number one is you own, like, you know, you have a sacred right to any territory you can take by force and hold by force.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are
exactly
the rules of the game, guys. You know, that's how it always has been. You know, like, well, this land is ours because of our religion, because of our ethnicity. It's like, no, this land is yours because you won it in a fight and because you've got enough soldiers there that nobody who could stop you thinks it's worth stopping you.
Yeah.
That's
exactly
how power is exchanged. Nobody, you know, Americans have this fetish with like voting and democracy. And it's like, you know, you have voting does less than you think it does. Voting is less important than you think it is. You know, I mean, I don't know how better to say it. It's like, you see, everybody seems to think, well, if we only get rid of like Dark Brandon, if we only get rid of the bad orange man, it's like, you know, no, the rot's deeper than that. And there's, you know, you didn't vote your way into this mess. You're not going to vote your way out of it. I mean, I think it's a very American thing specifically to think that you can do that.
Precisely, precisely. No, this is not, it's democracy no longer matters. What matters is power and influence and how you can accrue it and how you can garner it and how you can kind of hold on to it, right? And America at this point in time is not able to hold on to it, right? I mean, as soon as, I mean, I'll talk about Israel again, but I think you and I, good sir, we both know that after the embassy attack on the Iranians, right? At this point, it's a done deal that the Israelis are going to be hit, right? And there's going to be another wider, shall we say, escalation in the conflict, right? But the thing is, once West Asia goes outside of American control fully, right? America at that point, it's like, okay, well, we have these super high gas prices and industrial society no longer works, right? Like, it doesn't matter who you can vote for at that point. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how good your technology is and all this other nonsense, right? If you can no longer run society properly, right? Because, I don't know, oil, gas, coal, they're no longer affordable, right? At that point, it's just like a complete free-for-all, right? And you're going to see like warlords and revolutions and these other things like taking shape and what have you, right? I mean, what? Russia in the 1990s, like one of the things Russians did was they bartered, right? And Malcolm Cheney was talking about this. They're like, okay, well, they bartered. What did they barter for? They bartered for like bottles of vodka, cigarettes, cigars, coffins, right? You're going to see something similar happen, right? When industrial society collapses, right, you're going to have barter, right? That's what people always move towards when these sets of things happen, right? And unfortunately, American people are very, very pampered, especially in the coastal cities. Obviously, as you go inside the country, people are more self-sufficient. But like most of these people will not survive, right? They're not a society like Russia, where like in the 1990s, you literally had government employees working in the subway and you asked them, oh, how long have you not been paid? And he's like, oh, they stopped giving me paychecks 5 years ago, but I still show up 5 a.m. every morning and work the subway, right? You're not going to have a similar thing like that happen for New York subway, or you're not going to have something similar happen for the bus system and so on and so forth. So it's these little things, right? But these little things, they add up. And they add up into the hellscape of that society, right? So we're kind of headed toward that direction, unfortunately. you're going to have all these people. They've realized that, okay, well, nothing works. We're on our own. We have to barter for stuff. And oh, by the way, I'm living in the suburbs, or oh, I'm living in the cities and I do not have any real skills, right? I used to work as a IT person or whatever. I don't have any real skills. Oh, can someone please have mercy on me? And in which case, no, they won't. They won't.
Yeah, no,
because,
I think you're going to see like a large, I would expect at least a downturn the size of the Soviet Union after the global American empire collapses. You know, at least 25 to 50% decline in the standard of living. That's at least. So,
at least,
you know,
yeah,
that's
yeah, yeah.
Bad. It's not going to be good. That's doom. You know, that's like, I think focusing on how do we cushion that blow? How do we prepare for it? How do we extricate ourselves from that situation? You know, understanding that is better than worrying about, like, who was that clown? The guy Hartman on Substack who had this masturbation fantasy about the Proud Boys all getting together to kill black people and gays to celebrate Trump's second thing. And then Trump told Israel to convert to Christianity. And it's this rant. You get these crazy ideas about what tyranny looks like. And it's no, tyranny looks like people are hungry, so they look for a tyrant.
Precisely. Precisely. No, they're still unserious, right? They know that America is on its last legs, but they're still in that fantasy bubble and delusion, right? I mean, if you want to know what hellscape looks like, you can talk to an average Bengali who was alive during the 1973-1974 famine. Or you can go back to the historical record. Like, we had a famine in 1770. This is the very first famine that was engineered by the British East India Company, right? And out of our total population of like 30 million, we lost 10 million people, right? So that's what actual doom looks like. So all this other stuff, it's all cope, it's all hope, it's all like fantasy, like you said, good sir, it's all delusion, right? And unfortunately, it appears that because there's such a proliferation of unseriousness, like you were saying, good sir, you're going to have this doom, gloom, and despair happen, right? And after it happens, there's going to be a slow learning curve that, okay, this is what the real world is actually like. This is how we're actually supposed to behave. And oh, by the way, all this other fantasy stuff that I was doing for the last 5 to 10 years, this is all garbage. Throw it out the dustbin, right? That's basically what's going to happen, unfortunately, right? Some people obviously are going to learn much faster. They're going to go out into, I don't know, rural Minnesota or like one of these other places. And they're going to be like, okay, well, we've kind of figured out how to do things. It's going to be like, it's not the best way of living, but hey, we're going to somehow survive and do better, right? But that's not, you know, out of the 340 million or so that are inside the continental USA, very few of those people are going to be like living that kind of lifestyle.
No, I mean, I think there's just, that's the problem is also when you plan for a war that's going to be based on 1984 or Mad Max or the Hunger Games, you're not planning for the fight you've got on the ground. You're strategizing for your fantasy. And it's like, you're not going to win because, you know, you're basically hitting a shadow on the wall. You're not doing anything to address the real problem, which, you know, again, for me, the real problem is we're going to see a hard economic decline, a downturn in the standard of living. And that would be when I'd really worry about Americans electing dictators for life, not if Donald Trump or Joe Biden win this election.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, like elections, like I said, good. So elections no longer matter. And the tyrants and the dictators, they're very, very near, right? And it's people are like, oh, where are they going to come from? Well, they're going to come from the grassroots. That's basically where they're going to come from. They're going to be men of very high ambition, right? And what was that quote? I think this is actually my quote. I don't want to take too much credit, but I came up with this quote. I'm like, gold, concubines, and conquest. That's what all young men eventually gravitate towards if they don't have a moral system, if they don't have a framework or what have you, right? But you're going to have young men who gravitate.
If they
in that
have
direction.
A moral system, they find a moral system that justifies gold, concubines, and conquest. So it's
yeah,
100%
that's also true.
Yeah.
That's also true. That's also true.
Yeah,
that's
is
also
like
true.
That is, and that's what people are going to look for. And as the world collapses, you know, you're going to see people who are good at getting resources to their community, people who make those connections. They start forming the sort of mafias that formed the Russian oligarchies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, I mean, I would expect to see that. The one thing that would concern me about the possibility of foreign troops on American shores is America in extremis, somebody really pushed to the wall, we're starting to lose American territory, calls in either Chinese soldiers or makes a deal with somebody to stay in power, essentially setting it up. I mean, I think the problem would be, I can't imagine China or Russia being stupid enough to try to start a land war in America.
Yeah, but the thing is, right, it all comes down to interests, right? So they might think to themselves, okay, well, if the Chinese grab the land and if they give me some goody second-rate or third-rate position, I can rake in a lot of money, right? And there's a lot of people like that in America, right? They're not actually loyal to America. They're loyal to the almighty dollar, right? And so they're like, you know what? America's already fucked. So let me just go out into the world and find myself a new patron. Oh, look, the Chinese. Oh, why don't I do it for them? I mean, during the Century of Humiliation, this happened a lot. Like a lot of ethnic Chinese, like a lot of native Chinese, they sold off their country for pennies, right? And they told the Germans or the Austrians or the Italians that, oh, this is what you do and this is how you win. And oh, when this is over, can I please get a position in your like puppet government or what have you, right? Or whatnot. So no, that's going to happen. I mean, honestly, it's at this point, it's baked in the cake that there's going to be foreign rule of American soil, right? I don't think, however, that they're going to go too much inland. I think it's going to be like a Century of Humiliation type situation where it's like, oh, the Chinese, they get like this big port city, right? And it's basically like a Chinese business district. Like, I don't know. I mean, Hong
like
Kong
the Chinese,
is not there.
Basically like a Hong Kong, but with Chinese control a section of the United States with a big port. I could honestly see from there the Chinese doing that with numerous ports.
I mean, they exactly. And like some people are like very, very pessimistic. They're like, oh, isn't that already true? No, it's not. Like if you go to like a Canadian city like Vancouver, you could argue that, okay, there's a lot of like private real estate moguls and all these other things from the East Asian countries, right? But de facto, it's still a part of Canada, right? But what's going to happen is de facto, it's going to become a part of China, and China is going to use it where, oh, there's a governor sitting there. And then he's like, okay, well, the rest of the country, if you don't follow our way of life, we're not going to trade with you. And oh, if you still want to rebel against us, we're going to cut off food to you. That's basically, that's the next step. The next step is, okay, you're not going to follow our way of life. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut off food to you. Right. And now all you Americans and Canadians who bitch and whine about freedom and liberty and all this other stuff, do that on an empty stomach for the next 3 weeks and then come back to us after you surrender. That's basically going to be their new way of running things. Right. And this is going to happen, unfortunately, for the next few decades or so.
I expect the southwestern United States is going to go back. I mean, large chunks of it already are majority Hispanophone, ethnic Mexican and ethnic Central American. It's going to go back to what it was. They're going to be ruled by these people. You're already seeing it. A lot of people are talking about, you know, the immigrants are taking over these particular stretches. A lot of what they'll do, they'll go into small towns where, you know, there's basically nobody's there because nobody else could afford to do it. And they set up their own little Spanish language communities. They get along just fine. You know, they're used to living on a standard that Americans might not be used to living to, but one we're going to get used to pretty quickly.
Yeah, pretty much. And basically the thing is, right, what's going to happen is they're going to consolidate their power by calling in people from overseas, right? Whether it's someone like the Venezuelan government, they're going to be like, oh, Bolivar and socialist bros from Venezuela, or oh, Colombian drug cartel bros, help us out, right? We're your people, right? You may not like us, but hey, we are your people. Help us out. Help us gain a foothold in America. And that's basically what's going to happen. And they're going to adopt the Chinese way of doing things in the sense that, okay, we're going to have one or two big port cities. If you don't listen to us, we're going to starve you. All right. And then slowly over time, they're going to inch inward, right? So people are going to be so hungry, they're going to sell their land to them and so on and so forth. So it's going to be a combination of basically what the British East India Company did, as well as like, you know, some of these other things. But no, that's the future I see for America. It's a conquered nation in all but name. That's, I mean, honestly, this is why you don't pursue global hegemony, global empire, and all this other stuff, right? Because after your 15 minutes of fame is over, everyone looks at you as the enemy, and they combine forces, they join forces to take you out, right? Which is like, if you're like pro-American, if you're a patriot of America, if you're an American nationalist, whatever you want to call yourself, that's the worst possible outcome, right? And even if you delude yourself into thinking that, okay, well, these people don't have agency, it's the actual Jew, the actual power is with the Jews, and because the Jews are like running the whole show, that's the reason why the Africans, the Asians, the Arabs, and the Chinese are rising up. I mean, bro, you want to believe that? Okay, believe that right up until the last
moment. If the
moment,
Jews
right?
have so much damned power over everything in the world, how come they can't stop people from kicking them out of their cities and countries? You know, I hate to be blunt here, but, you know, maybe if I had like power over the world, you know, not having millions of my people die in concentration camps. And I know somebody's going to say it was only a couple hundred thousand. Don't want to have that argument. Sorry. But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's kind of like,
exactly.
For as much hassle as they get, I'm kind of wondering, you know, you guys are seriously incompetent world leaders.
Yeah. And like, if you had all this power, right? If you had all this power, why is it the case that you can't stop October 7th from happening, right? Like, allegedly, you've got the world's most sophisticated electronic warfare unit. You've got all this surveillance. You've incorporated artificial intelligence into all your units. You've got all this stuff going for you. Why on earth can you not stop a bunch of ragtag bros in their pickup trucks and, like, using low-tech paragliders to, like, kick your ass, right? That's the thing, right? So.
Yeah. Because you fell victim to the same mindset that's crushing like European and American armies. This is happening all over the world. It's really hard to fight a light mobile force that's really not very well organized, but hits quick and leaves quick.
Yeah.
Especially a force that has tunnels they can go into where you have no idea where they are.
Yeah. I mean, the tunnels make it almost impossible for the Israelis, right? But even without tunnels, like if you, good sir, if you go to Operation Barkhane, which was, I think, 2014 to 2022, it was the French Foreign Legion, French mercenaries, and the French army in general, right? It was them against, whatchamacallit, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, that part of the world, right? They were saying that, oh, we're trying to kill terrorists, and that's all rubbish, right? They were basically trying to extract they were trying to hold on to their African possessions, right? Operation Barkhane was their last effort by the French to hold on to that place. Because you were saying, good sir, that whether it's the African franc or all these other things, right? France has a lot of like interest in that region. But no, they couldn't beat a bunch of dudes who don't even have sandals, right? They couldn't beat them because they were super mobile. They knew the terrain. They knew how to maneuver and everything, right? And yeah, you can send your jets, right? And these guys don't have any anti-air system. Okay, fair enough. You can send your jets, kill some women and kids, right? But
classic
the thing is,
American thing. We do this all the time. Yeah, well, if we have a revolution here, you guys just got rifles. We got nuclear bombs. It's like, well, okay, what you're saying is you got an air force, but biggest air force in the world can drop all the bombs they got sooner or later. You got to put boots on the ground to hold terrain. That's just you. Unless you invent robot boots, they got to be boots from people wearing the uniform of your army.
Yeah. I mean, they won't be able to build. Yeah. They won't be able to build the robots though, because they don't have the manufacturing to do so. But no, even if they do all that, no. But they were doing all these like bombing runs, and then they realized that this is not doing anything, right? Because there's like all these decoys, which are not actual installations that were being set up. In addition to that, yeah, they're killing a lot of civilians, but they're not actually achieving their military objectives because all the guys are not just tunnels, right? They're just disappearing into the sand dunes and stuff, right? So. It's basically a losing proposition. I mean, the Americans are basically, their way of warfare has been fully debunked. Whether it's their proxies doing it, like the French or the British, or whether it's they themselves doing it, it's been completely debunked. There's no way at this point to salvage these things, right?
Yeah, we're where the British and French empires were in the post-war. We have to unwind it. You know, Britain was smart enough to unwind in a relatively peaceful manner. I mean, that's, you know, but it's like we're not being that smart. We seem to want to go out kicking and screaming.
Yeah. And this is what's going to cause the most damage, unfortunately. Now, I have seen some good signs in the sense that, I don't know, good sir, if you've been following the situation, but I think yesterday night, Nancy Pelosi, right, of all people, right, Nancy Pelosi, the octogenarian, you know, stock market manipulator Nancy Pelosi, right? She sends a letter with like 40 other people saying that, okay, we need to stop immediate military arm transfers to Israel right now, right? And even Joe Biden, who we know is not really in charge, right? He's like, you know, he's all over the place. The collective Biden is in charge, right? But even he's like, okay, we need to get an immediate ceasefire. I think the process of the so-called special relationship, which the Americans had with the Israelis, I think it's beginning to rapidly implode. And we're beginning to see that because these people, they've realized that, okay, we need to not be seen in the same room with these people, right? Because everyone else knows that this is a genocide and they're going to criticize us. And whatever prestige we have left will evaporate and it will disappear, right? So they're trying to do this, right? That being said, I think what's going to happen is that once the Americans completely withdraw support for Israel on the military side of things, the Israeli society is going to collapse. Because the only reason, like, you can have a country of like 9, 10 million people and you can have like the fourth largest air force in the world is if you parasitize and you have like the Americans and all these other guys send you their weaponry, right? Other than that, right, if you only have that small population, you can't really do anything. Because a military outpost in that part of the world, like you were saying in the very first episode, good sir, you can't really support a military outpost in that part of the world unless you continuously keep on sending weapons there.
That, yeah, and we don't have those weapons anymore. It's, I think Israel is kind of fishing around for somebody who will replace America as its new patron. You know, they're looking at maybe making inroads towards Russia or towards China because they think they'll be less antsy about the human rights stuff, but they both have relations within the Middle East that they don't want to endanger by getting too close to Israel.
Yeah, precisely.
That's
precisely.
Like they don't have, there's no good reason for them to do it. You know, Russia doesn't need to protect the Suez Canal. Russia doesn't really need a base on the Mediterranean. If it does, it's got Crimea.
Precisely, yeah.
You know, it's like they don't have, there's no, we wanted that because we wanted a place where we could have, like, where we could look, watch over the oil flow and keep the petrodollar flowing. You know, the petrodollar dies when Israel dies, and that's been the real reason we're holding up there.
Yeah. Once Israel implodes, there's no more American force projection in the region because all these other guys, whether it's these small tripwire forces in Syria, where they kind of train all the terrorists from in Idlib, whether it's that place or whether it's any of these other Gulf monarchies where they have like, I don't know, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 troops, they become basically, at that point, the people in the region will basically rise up in rebellion and kick them out by force. And you're going to see tens of thousands of Americans die, right? And you're going to have like public outcry in America. Oh, do something, you know, go after those Arabs, you know, like bomb those Arabs back to the Stone Age, right? But then everyone's going to be like, guys, we don't have sea lift or airlift to do that anymore, right?
Or we'll bring a carrier into the forces. We'll have the carrier sunk by a $20,000 drone, and we'll leave with our tail between our legs.
Did you see that report? Good sir, did you see that report about that Danish ship, the frigate, which it was trying to intercept the four drones, right? And these are like super cheap drones, like $20,000, $5,000 drones. And what happened was the detection system malfunctioned because what the Houthi, the Ansarallah, what Yemen's Ansarallah figured out was that if you have four drones coming in from certain angles, the detection system trips up and it malfunctions basically. So,
so you've got people now who are like, again, these are not people with degrees in radar science technologies. These are people with basic, you know, machine in educations are figuring out how to get past your mega $1 million weapon system designed, you know, by the finest minds the U.S. Army could pay for.
Yeah, this is why, like, I always joke that I don't believe in science, right? It's like, what, Denmark is one of those countries which has, like, I don't know, IQ average of, like, 103, 104. It's such a rubbish number. I mean, if that number actually meant anything and you're up against Yemen, which is, like, one of the poorest countries in West Asia and whose average IQ apparently is, like, 75, 80, some low number like that, why are you guys not, like, wiping the floor with them, right? This is why I don't believe in this stuff. It's just so ridiculous, right? So no.
IQ is a test of the your measure of your abilities to like to do activities in a Western society. You know, having a high IQ means you have a high verbal IQ, that you can do a lot of reading, that you can handle a lot of complex stuff. You know, being really smart in Yemen might be, you know, I've memorized the Quran and I know every trail in 100-mile radius, you know, every foot trail in 100-mile radius in every direction.
Yeah, precisely, precisely. No, but yeah, there's an arrogance in Westerners, which unfortunately is kind of led them to this point, right? And the Danish, to their credit, they realized that, okay, our system is tripping. They figured out how to screw around with it, so let's just get out of here, right? And I think their defense chief got sacked because of this scandal, right? But no, this is basically, it may seem like a small example, but this is literally the entirety of the U.S. Navy, right? They will not have any success whatsoever, right? They're already saying that, okay, look, Yemen's Ansarallah, please stop firing at us. And if you do, pretty please, if you please do that, we're going to lift you out of the terror list, right? And we're going to do some other things, right? And the Yemenis are just laughing at them. They're like, okay, we never wanted that to begin with. We wanted you to lift the blockade on Gaza, right? So, no, that's the thing. And they're going to get their ass whooped, basically, because their ships are complete sitting ducks now. Like I said, there's going to be a lot of dead American soldiers, unfortunately, right? There's going to be like tens of thousands dead. And there's going to be public outcry back home. Like you said, good sir, they're going to try and send a token boutique force there. That's going to get blown to bits. And then the Americans are going to get even angrier. And then revolution might hit the streets, right? So, no, like, you know, people have different learning curves, right? Like, if you go to Mongolia, right? The Mongols used to, like, what do you call it? After the Mongol conquests, right? They ran most of the known world, right? They had an empire, which was the second largest empire ever formed. They had hundreds of millions of people, under their thumb. They had all these things for about two or three centuries, right? But after that, they basically retreated and retreated. They receded. And now they're kind of, okay, there's some Mongolians living in Mongolia, but there's even more Mongolians living in China, in Inner Mongolia, right? And they're like a very, very, whatchamacallit, they're very humble people. I mean, obviously, there's exceptions to the rule. They're like death metal people who sing about, I don't know, Genghis Khan being resurrected and Mongolian Empire being, you know, reformed or what have you. But other than those weirdos, right? Most people in Mongolia are very, very peaceful, very, very humble. They talk about the world a certain way, right? I think America is going to go through that same centuries-long decline, getting their head beaten into the dirt, like you were saying, good sir, and that's just going to keep continuing for a while still. But they've had their moment in the sun. They've had their 15 minutes of fame. After this point, America will never rise again because of all the reasons we talked about. All those strategies will be used. All those other things will be used. Grudges are important, dear listeners and readers. Grudges are an important thing. If you have too many grudges, like if people have too many grudges against you, they're going to capitalize on them, right? And they're going to surround you on all sides and defeat you. So after that point, right, it's very difficult for you to rise back up again, right? So that's the situation. So,
yeah, I mean, I would expect that. I mean, America as a federal nation, as like one nation, the first half of American history, we really saw ourselves much more as a, you know, it's a bad word from some people, I'm going to use it anyway, a confederacy of states. We were kind of, each of us were essentially independent states. There were a few big things that the federal government handled. You know, we were closer to the Holy Roman Empire without an emperor than we were to, like, you know, the big global American empire we are today.
Yeah. I mean, it was neither holy nor Roman. Neither holy nor Roman nor an emperor.
Yeah, so, no, it was America, that thing, but our states had much more power over, you know, local governments had more power than state governments, and state governments had more power than federal governments. That was the way it all, that was the standard way of things being run in America. And I mean, that's, it's a very European way of running things. You know, we tended to think historically of like those, you know, I always like to say, you know, it never occurred to the Vikings to take more, to want more gold than they could carry with them or more land than they could plow.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was trying to think about that acronym, WASP, WASP. So
yeah, America white Anglo-Saxon is Protestant. Yeah.
Yes. So America is neither Western anymore, nor is it Anglo, nor is it Saxon, nor is it Protestant.
No.
That's all.
No,
That's all
we
gone.
lost. When we lost our religion, I think that's one of the things you're seeing Richard Dawkins coming out now as a cultural Christian. I think once we lost religion, a lot of Western cultural and ethnic and identity, a lot of our philosophy, a lot of our moral philosophy was as rooted in the Bible as, the Ummah is rooted in the Quran, and we basically took the Bible and threw it out. And it's like, okay, yes, you could talk about freedom of religion and everything. I'm generally pro freedom of religion, including your freedom to have no religion, but it's like we have a human religious impulse. I mean, we found Cro-Magnons. We found evidence of religious worship going back, maybe before we were human. We seem to have a re, you know, there's something inside the human spirit that wants to worship something greater than itself outside itself. And it's like, I think the fact that that's so wired in there, maybe it's there for a purpose.
So this is actually a fascinating topic. I remember there was a study, and this was done by cognitive scientists, right? So these are like Westerners who are not really into religion and all this other stuff. But they went all over the world. So their primary test subjects were kids under the age of 10, from different cultures, societies, ethnicities, etc. So Japanese kids, obviously, Indian kids, kids from West Asia, kids in Europe, and so on and so forth, right? And the universal thing that they found was that when they spoke about imaginary friends, right? And when they spoke about the world of the unseen, right? They always gave the imaginary friend the exact same attributes that, okay, he is not in any single location. He is basically able to see us, but we're not able to see him. Right, and so on and so forth, right? So when you were saying, good sir, that is the impulse, that's definitely within every human heart, right? Every human heart has a God-shaped hole, basically. And once you're like, okay, well, we don't need God anymore, we're gonna fill up this hole in our hearts. It's not a God-shaped hole. Oh, it's just a hole we can fill up with secular humanism or some of this other stuff. And then once we do that, we're gonna have like the sexy, sciencey, secular utopia, right? Like Dawkins and all these other people, right? So no, that is now a complete failure. It has been demonstrated as a complete failure, and people are going to reap the consequences for that. I mean, I think Dawkins single-handedly has destroyed a significant chunk of Western civilization, at least with regard to, okay, how much damage can an individual person do? He's kind of up there with regard to
I
doing
mean,
it, doing so
I
much
think
damage.
he finally realized, okay, well, maybe like rooting something in a Christian morality, in a Muslim morality. I mean, in any morality that where the Hindu, Buddhist, any morality where the best and brightest members of your civilization have spent a great deal of time thinking about difficult questions and coming up with answers for them. You need that kind of structure there, and we lost that. When your whole structure becomes do whatever you want so long as nobody else gets hurt, that's not really a structure you can build any kind of a moral worldview on. Do whatever I want so long as it feels good, and you wind up with this hedonistic, nihilistic hellhole.
That's the situation now, and what's it called? It's like Western civilization is now what? It's now no more than magic dirt. It's like, oh, if you come to our country and if you assimilate to its values, whatever those are. I mean, I always say that West value today is war, usury, pornography, and materialism, right? So if you assimilate to those values, right, you're now a Westerner, right? And so it's to be expected that nobody wants to assimilate to this stuff anymore, right? They're like, okay, well, no, thank you. That's a very bad deal. I'm not interested in signing on the dotted line for that stuff. So
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we had, we had our big sell was we had the prosperity, we make things, and then that's how we got rich because we had this insanely powerful manufacturing sector. We threw that out to become like the British Empire Mark II, and now we don't really have that any, I think America will rebuild. The different regions of America are likely to wind up their own countries just because we're the Southern United States and the Northern United States are very, very different from each other. Although that we may be less different. One of the defining things that defines Southern culture, you don't have a lot in the rest of the United States. The Southerners are the only Americans who know what it is to lose a war on your own soil. That changes your whole worldview a whole lot. We may be we're going to all be learning that, but they already know.
They have a head start, basically. So they're going to have several advantages, basically. Yeah.
You know,
That's basically
but
it.
yeah, we never lost a, we've never, I mean, you can't really even argue we lost Vietnam or Afghanistan because we never defined anything where we could say we won. But we haven't had, you know, we have not really, we haven't won a major conflict. Nobody in our, in civ, nobody alive right now has ever witnessed a world war. Certainly nobody who is in the industry right now, nobody in the mil, no military leader. And, you know, I think Americans are getting back to the being serious, yet we're not being serious when we're thumping our chests and we're saying, you know, well, we'll, you know, we'll do this time what we did the last two times, you know, which actually in both cases would be coming in relatively late, arming everybody, and like using that to strengthen our own position. We're not going to do that again. You know, this time we're going to come charging, you know, we're going to come charging boldly in. We're going to wind up in a bloodbath against people who don't have our weapons, but they have light trucks.
No, America has created too many enemies for itself, and at this point it's a cooking the frog scenario, like boiling the frog scenario. That's basically where we're at, right? What's going to happen to Israel in the next few weeks and months is basically going to happen to America in a larger scale, right? It's going to be like slowly cooked on all sides. That's the situation. I
That's
mean,
doom.
whatchamacallit?
The
Yeah, the
doom
doom
cometh.
cometh. The
Yeah,
doom cometh.
I think with Israel, I've noticed my friends in Israel are starting to, it, I mean, I could feel a certain sympathy for people. You know, you could say colonist all you want, but like a kid who comes over in his like t late teens, early 20s to a foreign country, like because he his ancestors lived there, picks up a gun and starts shooting at people who are shooting back at him. You know, I can understand why this man is disappointed, you know, 50 years later to discover that no, we didn't get that Jewish state that I really thought we were always going to have. You know, I could feel sympathy, but I think they're starting to understand this war is you can't win this war. You know, you don't have the you've always won it due to having material support from other people. You don't really have that material support. You don't have enough troops to continue this. You know, you can't, you know, the longer this goes on, the more people are going to die, the harder it's going to be to make a peaceful, like some kind of peaceful solution. But that's the option you've got. You know, learn to live with each other or learn to live with each other or keep shooting at each other. You know, that's those are the two options.
And I think, good sir, you were saying that many Israelis will not be leaving, which is true, right?
Yeah.
But in a country of like 9 or 10 million people, you don't need everyone to leave. If even 1 million of them leave, and I think last time I checked the number, it's like 500,000, 600,000 have already left, right? I mean, a large part of the Haredi are just going to leave because they're scared. They're like basically their feet are shaking at the idea that they're about to be drafted to go to the front, right? But if even 1 or 2 million people leave and the remaining 7 or 6 million remain, that's basically a destroyed society. Like, that's not a society that can function, right? And the only thing left for you to do is to sue for peace, right? You should sue for peace. You should go for a diplomatic settlement. And your idea of like, okay, well, we're going to have these two big warehouses of humans, one of them being Gaza and the other being West Bank, those can't be. Those can't exist anymore, right? So yeah, you gotta erase the borders between them, and then whatever you get, that's not gonna be Israel. That's gonna be a different society. That's gonna be
You're going to get Greater Palestine, which has a large Jewish population. That's what I
that's
expect.
what
You
you're
know,
gonna get. Yeah, that's what
that
you're gonna
is what
get.
you're going to
Exactly.
get. It's like nobody likes that. You know, everybody thinks, you know, well, we're going to have Palestine from the river to the sea. You know, you're probably still going to have to deal with Jews, and you probably still are going to squabble with each other. But, you know, You don't have any choice. You live together, you know, you can like you're there to be each other's learning opportunity.
Precisely, precisely. And obviously, people who engaged in war crimes, ethnic cleansing, genocide, they're going to get punished, as always, right? Whether it's the actual trials or vigilante justice or this other stuff. But everyone else, you know what? They get an opportunity to live with us, right? So that's the thing. I mean, honestly, Islamic law is very clear on treating the people of the book with respect. And also, we've had very, very amicable relationship with Jewish people for much of the past millennia and a half. The only gray spot or black spot would be Israel and its existence, where like they've tried to equate Zionism with Judaism, which is not the case, right? But no, we're gonna have that opportunity again. And yeah, that's what and the thing is, right? Now that you
Historically,
mention it.
Jews in the Ummah were much better off for most of history, much better off in the Ummah than they were in Christendom, had more opportunities, were less likely to get trouble from, like, you know, some random drunk.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
exactly.
There's
And
no reason this war is entirely over one small piece of land.
yeah, it's over for us. It's not just a piece of land. It's for us. It's Masjid Al-Aqsa, right? So that's the holiest of holy for us with regard to these sorts of things. But no, it is going to come to an end. I mean, we are going to be victorious, inshallah. And they can live with us. And the thing is, right? I fully expect the tables to turn in the following way, right? You're already beginning to see anti-Semitism and anti-Judaism and these types of feelings come back in Europe and America in mass, right?
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. People are
at this point,
openly. The ADL can't even open their comments anymore because they were just getting flooded. You know, not even like the kind of, well, we get a few critics and then that gets the rest of our donors upset. Like, you know, they were getting flooded with criticism. You know, most of the, all the, like, it's now, you know, the people who were the big defenders of Judaism are on the ropes.
precisely, precisely. And like the right wing, and Malcolm Ciuna, he said this, he's like, the right wing in America is basically collapsing as we speak, right? The so-called establishment, right? So Ben Shapiro is not viewed as, you know, off the right anymore. He's viewed as, okay, well, this guy's just pro-Israel. And then Candace Owens, right, when she got fired, right, she's like, okay, well, I can't say Christ is king, I can't say all this other stuff, right? At that point, right, good sir, it becomes a very simple question, right? Is it Jesus, peace be upon him, or is it Barabbas? Who do you pick?
Yeah. It's
Right?
like,
Who do you pick?
yeah, I mean, if for a Christian, there's no, okay, Christ is king. We believe Christ is king overall. You know, telling me I can't say Christ is king is like, you know, well, you could be here, but you can't say Muhammad is the prophet because you might offend some of our listeners. It's like, no, the guy's a Muslim. He believes Muhammad's the prophet. Deal. You know, that's
And this is
exactly
what's
it.
going to exactly. And this is what's going to destroy the American right? Because whether we like to admit it or not, the ethno-nationalist crowd, all these guys, they're the minority. The majority of American right people who are outside the establishment, they are Christians, right? They're basically God-fearing people, and they take this stuff seriously, right? So if you alienate them, that's basically, you've given the game away at that point, right? So at that point, they're going to be like, okay, well, what's the point in me staying here, right? Because, you know, I can't say Christ is king. I can't say that Jesus is, you know, Lord and Savior. I can't say that stuff. So okay, what's the point? Like, you're not America first, you're America last. That's basically the
Yeah,
attitude you're gonna
you're
have.
Israel first. And that's like, you know, that's your prerogative, but like, you know, I'm America first. I'm an American, you know, I'm predominant, like I'm an American. My preeminent concern is with the American people. You know, I would hope that my American government would have the same concern, just like I would hope that anybody else's government had the concern of its people as its primary thing. You know, I'm not, you know,
And
Israel doesn't have. For me, you know, again, that whole Christian, like the evangelical, that idiotic idea that we have to help the Jews build the third temple. No, we don't. We don't. No. The third temple, if they want to build something on there, you know, I mean,
I mean, if they want to
I
build
have no
something
feel.
there,
Yeah,
yeah,
I,
if
you
they
know,
want to, yeah, if yeah, go ahead, go ahead, go ahead.
I mean, it's like I have no. I would not want to see Al-Aqsa knocked down on historical architectural grounds, on spiritual grounds, but I mean, it's like, it wouldn't, as a theological thing, it's not a, that's not a Christian ceremony. A Jewish temple there is not a Christian thing either. You know, it's wonderful.
Yeah,
You
yeah,
can,
yeah.
like, you don't have to, your theology should not revolve around, like, making Israel happy. That's, you know, you were supposed to
Yeah.
get away from that. That's, you know, it's just that idiocy has been so responsible, used so much. America, there's so many American conservatives who are just this knee-jerk pro-Israel because they think that the God and the Bible tell them to be. And it's like, no, you know, if you have to take a side in this, take the side of the Palestinian Christians who are dying.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people don't notice, but 7 to 10% of all Palestinians are in a minority group. So they're either a Christian, which is about 7 or 8%, or they are whatchamacallit? They are Druze, which is another small minority religion, or they are atheists, but most of them are basically communists, right? So 7% doesn't seem like a lot, but if you do 7% of 5.5 million, that is a lot of people,
Hundreds
folks.
of thousands.
That, yeah, you're talking about what? You're talking about well over 400,000 at that point, well over 300,000 at the bare minimum,
Yeah,
right?
there's
So,
also a lot of Christians in Syria. There's a lot of Christians, you know, Lebanon. I don't see people have this idea the Middle East is all Muslim. And it's like, okay, Druze aren't Muslims, Christians aren't Muslims.
yeah,
You know, it's
so.
not, you know, it, I think you've also pointed out that really only about 20% of the world's Muslims live in the area we call the Middle East.
Precisely, yeah. 400 million, and there's
200
two
million.
billion of us. Most Muslims live in the whatchamacallit, the Indian subcontinent. So there's 600 million plus Muslims living in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh combined. So
You, yo, that, okay, that, yeah, no, I realize there's a lot that makes, that's a big.
yeah. I mean, if you draw a circle and you in that circle you put in China and India, and you put in Bangladesh and Pakistan, that's like, okay, well, 3.5 billion, 4 billion people live here, and everyone else out there is like another 4 billion, right? So, like you're saying, right? China calls itself navel of the world. Hey, they might be onto something, right? So,
No, so that's
so.
like, I mean, I think that's just been the thing. Like, and there's also the whole thing of like, look, I enjoy reading crusade stories. I once jokingly called my TikTok account Reclaim Constantinople. It's fun to fantasize about being a noble crusader, but I at no point did I ever forget that I did not have an army of knights to come and retake Constantinople. You know, these people seem to think that they've got, you know, there are people who seem to think that no, you know, we're going to de-Islamize Europe. And it's like, you know, I'd say you and what army? How about we'll start with you and what squadron and we'll work our way up from there? You know, you don't, you know, you seem to think that you're going to say, get issue sternly worded commands and millions of people are going to say, oh, you're right. I'm going to navigate, I'm going to leave now.
That's never going to happen.
No.
The thing with people is that human nature is very predictable. If you try to force people into a certain policy, right? And especially if it involves their grandpa and their grandma leaving and going back, right? To their, I mean, some of them don't even have any place to go back because their homes were completely demolished and destroyed by the Israelis and the Americans. But even if you are like, okay, well, you have a place to go back there, they're going to be like, well, no, because I have ties to this region. I have sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters. And, you know, if you want to, you know, I'm an old man and I'm an old woman. If you want to harm me, well, I mean, I guess you're gonna fight against my entire clan, right? And if it's a situation where, okay, well, there's this individualistic society in the West or whatever, and they're like, okay, we're gonna now start deportation, mass ethnic cleansing, mass genocide. At that point, you're basically making an enemy of the world, right? So no, it's unserious. It's completely ludicrous. Again, if people want to learn the hard way and they want to start this nonsense, then they're gonna get garner the consequences.
Yeah,
I don't
this
really
is
have
just,
anything
I'm
else to say to them.
seeing that just still so much of, I mean, again, I don't expect the internet to be a serious place. It never really was, you know, but I do kind of expect my political leaders to at least give the appearance of being serious. They just on all sides seem incapable of doing that. I mean, whatever you could say about Donald Trump, he does not appear to be a serious man. Joe Biden doesn't appear to be serious because Joe Biden doesn't appear to be coherent. You know, what happened to, like, you know, what happened to meritocracy? What happened to putting a, like, you know, smart, competent people in positions of power?
For whatever reason, that is now no longer the important thing.
Idiocracy.
Yeah,
We
idiocracy.
got
Idiocracy.
idiocracy.
I mean, it's worse than idiocracy. At least in idiocracy, the idiot leaders, they try to like do some good for their people. They're like, okay, well, we're gonna spray Mountain Dew on the crops and we're gonna try and grow stuff, right? But nowadays, like, these leaders don't even care about their own people. They're like, okay, we're gonna pursue hegemony, whatever the cost, and we're going to give them like, we're not gonna like send them diplomats. We're gonna send them emissaries of our rotting, crumbling empire, and they're gonna just give you commands that you must execute. Why? Because we're America and we're number one. Like, what did Biden say? Biden said that, oh, we're the United States of America, for God's sake. We are the most powerful country in the goddamn world, right? And I'm like, bro, that ship has sailed. That's no
Yeah,
longer the case.
you're not. We have to learn to. Nobody, no American alive has ever, like working today, has ever lived really in, like, I remember the two power, like a bipolar world. We've never lived in a multipolar world, and that's what we're getting now. There's no longer one leader, there's no longer two leaders, there are going to be several leaders. And that's always been the way it was. You always had the Persian Empire next against, like, the Greeks, and you always had, like, on the Persians on the other side, there was the Indian Empires. There's, you know what I'm saying. There's always been lots of people in power, and that's fine. That keeps everybody honest.
Precisely. And the thing is, right, this is a historical anomaly that we've been in for the past 500 years or so. When the New World was discovered, right, the main killer of the Native Americans was disease, right? So the Columbine Exchange happened. Obviously, there were massacres. I mean, Bartolomé de Casa, he documented this pretty well. The Spanish and the Portuguese doing massacres of the Native Americans. But other than that, right, the main killer, 90%, were the diseases, right? And then you had the Columbine Exchange. You had like livestock, crops, and all these other things from the old world coming over. And they basically destroyed most of the indigenous stuff. And meanwhile, corn, maize, chocolate, sugar, these were taken back to the old world. And what happened was the quality of life of the average Joe, the laborer on the street or what have you, it went up. And rather than toiling away 60 hours a week, he only had to toil away 40 hours a week, right? And that extra 20 hours multiplied over hundreds of millions of people, that gave rise to an intellectual revolution, right? And eventually, right, you had that for about 300 or 400 years, and that's why Europe, or more specifically Great Britain and a couple of the German states, they got to the Industrial Revolution. So this is a historical anomaly for two reasons: the Columbine Exchange and the Industrial Revolution. Those are the two quintessential pillars of making the Western-led world order work, right? But now those things have dissipated, and we're basically reverting back to the mean, as they say, which is going to be like these giant empires coming back, these like civilization states coming back. And obviously you're going to have like balkanized models as well, of like, okay, lots of tiny statelets and all these other things. But for the most part, no, I see civilization states coming back. I mean, people argue that, okay, well, technology has gotten to the point where you can't have civilizational like larger order structures anymore. I disagree, simply because human beings have always been a whatchamacallit, belief centric animal. Whether it's the God-shaped hole rather in our hearts or other things, right? We've always kind of like organized in that fashion.
I mean, I also would note the people that are saying, well, we won't be able to do this because internet, are taking for granted that our current internet capacity is going to consistently expand and or can even consistently be maintained at the level it is. And I don't think that's really a sure thing either. I mean, I don't expect the internet to die. I expect that you're going to be having people using it for communications, but I do think that we are going to at some point start running out of the resources we need to make those servers. I mean, if China Taiwan blows up, where are we getting our semiconductors from?
You won't be, that's the thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the whole internet is dependent upon a lot of trade routes. It's dependent upon open trade, ready access to rare elements that are already running out, ready access to the kind of electricity it takes to run a server farm for something like an AOL or an Instagram. This is all, we are really, I think the internet, I mean, we will probably have cell phones for a few, like phones or stuff like that for a few centuries to come. But I don't think, you know, this whole idea of us being connected to the internet 24/7, you know, this may seem like a really strange idea to our children or our grandchildren, you know, like they'll have a hard time believing there was ever a time when it was like that.
Yeah, and the thing is, right, there's another thing we need to consider, good sir. It is that technological asymmetry will become the norm again, right? So if you go back to the pre-Columbine age, right, there were certain parts of the world where you could find certain goods and services, and in other parts of the world, you couldn't. So you're going to go back to that world. So in some parts of the world, there's going to be internet. And then in other parts of the world, well, we don't have the components anymore. There was a time, once upon a time, when we were on top of things and we traded and we got things. Now, not so much. Now those guys are in the port city. They starve us for food every time we want to rebel. And yeah, that's the situation we're in. And then the grandkids are going to be like, oh, you're just pulling our leg. We've always known the world as one where China, India, the Muslim world, and Russia ruled it, right? We never knew a world where, like, us Europeans and Americans ruled it. So they'll, you know, it'll be a world like that, basically. So,
yeah, and I think that's going to be fine. You know, it's not going to, it's neither going to be the, like, man in the high castle dream that a lot of, like, people on the right seem to have, or the Mad Max dream. You know, it's going to be a world where we have less money, we have less power, and but maybe, you know, we have less distractions and we have less cheap gewgaws to keep us distracted. You know, maybe it won't be an unqualified evil.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, it's a very old quote, but the quote is weak times create strong men. So you're gonna have that situation as well, right? So it's gonna be, whatchamacallit, like a lot of the 20th century had these movements in Africa for decolonization, right? And those leaders, a lot of them were assassinated by the Americans, but a lot of those leaders, the reason they got to leadership was because they lived in a world where Africa was basically under the boot of all these, like, colonial powers, right? And so they gained their skills and leadership acumen and whatnot from that situation. So similar things going to happen in occupied America. I mean, I say occupied, but it's going to be mostly the coastal cities. So it's going to be occupied America, occupied Europe. They're going to have the same situation. They're going to be like, okay, well, we need to, no one's coming to save us. You know, our superior genetics and superior technology is not going to save us. All of this is garbage. All of this, you know, science is fake. This is all garbage. Throw it out in the dustbin. What can we do at this moment in time with regard to local organizing, getting people on our side, you know, all this other stuff. And so you're going to have a new leadership class born out of that seriousness, right? There's going to be less unseriousness because, pragmatically speaking, if you're unserious, well, you just starve to death, right? So you're going to have
that situation. Unseriousness is a luxury.
Unseriousness is a luxury, and you're going to starve to death in that world, right? In that world where the West has been basically comprehensively defeated, right? Which is, I mean, it's the direction we're going into. Obviously, it's still possible to steer away from that, but if you're fighting three civilizations at the same time, I see that as the optimal, I see that as the, what's your mind, the probabilistic outcome at this point.
But we can't fight three civilizations. We can't fight, we'd have a very hard time. We can't fight two civilizations. We'd have a real, real war on our hands with Russia, with Iran, or with China. Any one of those would be a war. And I mean, we were going to get bloodied up. We're going to lose lots of men in that war. Two or three of them at once? No.
No. So, I mean, there was,
again, unseriousness.
Yeah, yeah, there's going to be. But at this point, good sir, I think, you know, sometimes you got to learn. What's that quote? Experience is a.
It's a hard teacher.
Harsh mistress, because she gives you the punishment first and the lesson second. I think that's how the quote goes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, she gives. Yeah. It's like, that's, we are going to pay for this because we've, you know, we're in a situation now where we don't have people who can, you know, just basically pull on the boots, say, okay, guys, I've got to tell you this news. It's bad news. now. Here's how we can do. Here's what we can do. But, you know, it's much easier to listen to people who are going to blow sunshine up your posterior about like how we're going to have a new, you know, some kind of new world order, or how everything is going to be wonderful. We're going to have spaceships going into like the horizon. And, you know, maybe we will, maybe we won't. But for the present time, I think we're going to be looking at a period of decline that's going to be extended probably for a couple generations.
Pretty much. And in general, right? And in general, like, the thing with doom, gloom, and despair is that even if you're not into that genre of stuff, what I always tell people is that the doom comics, I don't simply say that as a, like, walkaway line at the end of everything, right? The reason I say that is because more often than not in human history, the doom comics has been true. Rather than, oh, there's going to be shrub of joy and sunshines and rainbows, right? So I'm a very realistic and pragmatic person in that regard, right? So, no, like, it's better to be prepared for the worst rather than, like, have this optimistic, like, upbeat tone of life. Because otherwise, again, you're going to starve to death. All this other stuff, bad stuff's going to happen. So, yeah, I don't know. Is that... where we ended off, or
I think we could end it. Yeah, I think this is a pretty good place to wrap it up. Looking forward to next week and see what, you know, what unserious idiocy we'll start out by laughing at. But you know, I think this is really coming along well. I'm really happy with the way this is going. I look forward to, like, you know, we will be happy to take questions. Anybody in the audience got any questions? Just come to my Substack, come to Onoff Substack. Yeah, leave a question in our comments. We'll get back to you. We welcome all sorts of discussion from our listeners. You know, you guys are what make this worthwhile. So, you know, again, thank you very much, Anna. Thank you very much to everybody who's listening. And we will talk to you next week.
Thank you, good sir.
Take care. Bye now.